of course, emo itself is such an incredible, vast genre of infinite cool bands that emo was always going to happen. You know, Saves the Day was just a piece of that. But I do feel incredibly proud to have been a part of some of the earlier stages of emo.
This song will become the anthem of your underground. You're two floors down, getting high in the back room. If I flooded out your house, do you think you'd make it out? Or would you burn?
Welcome back to Labeled. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today's a cool one because we have a person who I consider to be a pioneer of the scene, Chris Conley from Saves the Day On, who is nothing if not original. His ability and willingness to listen and follow an inner voice led him to arrive early to the all-ages music scene and have great influence, and also to continue to evolve musically and not get stuck in a certain sound, even though commercial success would have wanted just that to happen. After having some releases on independent labels and setting the tone for the scene and exploding, Saves the Day signed to a major label, DreamWorks, and then turned in their album In Reverie, which was another evolution of direction and a departure from what radio, MTV, and fans were expecting, leading them to quickly be abandoned by the label. Nonetheless, it's Chris's and my favorite album of theirs. So I really enjoyed getting to hear Chris's perspective on it all, and I think you will too. Let's do it.
So where are you, Matt?
I'm in Seattle. I've been here.
Oh, okay.
You know I sound like I'm not from Seattle because I'm not.
But you're one of Chris's friends from up there. He goes up there a bunch.
Yep. So Chris, you know, Chris has been playing in my band Emory for a long time.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize you were in Emory.
Yep. Yeah. That's so my awesome. Band. Yeah.
Dude, that's great. It's so good to talk to you. I saw you guys play at Tahoe is for Lovers.
Oh, you were there? I didn't know you were there.
Yeah. I was there with my friends and you guys were so good. That was a great show. It looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was a really cool one. That spot was really cool to get to play in.
It was so cool. We saw a couple months before that, we saw, or maybe last summer, we saw Eric Church there.
Oh, wow.
Do you know that country star?
Yeah, I know his name, but I don't know his music that well.
Oh, it's so good. It was incredible. And so it was nice to be back. That's a great venue.
Do you listen to country?
I like several country stars, but I like them. I like the country radio, like country pop songs. Like Eric mm-hmm. Church's songs, I think are really cool pop songs, but with that country twang. And I like his lyrics, and he's got a really quirky, strange, high pitched voice mm-hmm. that I just absolutely love. There's a lot of country stuff that is, whenever I listen to it with intent, it's some of the best, most well-written music I've heard.
Yeah, I have the same kind of thing with it, where when I tune into it and pay attention to it, I go through phases, like maybe once every decade, twice a decade, where I'll start paying attention to country.
When the songs get good again after being bad for about 8 years.
Yeah, maybe that's it. There's some cycle to it. But if I put my attention on it, I find stuff I really like. And then sometimes it starts to get on my nerves and I need distance from it.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets a little repetitive. Same with any pop genre, I feel like, popular music. I noticed that when I was a kid, it would be like, every 7 to 10 years, there was like a wave for 1 or 2 years of really good music. And then for the next 8 years, everybody would just be copying that and it would get watered down more and more until something new happened again.
Okay, well, we're already in really cool territory. I just want to stay here and ride this wave because I'm fascinated by that type of analysis, especially for people that have been around to see multiple cycles or participate in that. And that's just the nature of things getting popular, then they get copied and watered down. Is that what's going on?
I think that's what I see happening. I remember when, Nirvana came out, and within 6 months you had a dozen or more bands, two dozen bands that sounded like Nirvana. It sounded like they were singing like with their jaw dropped. Uh-huh. You know that? Remember what we called it? Jaw rock?
Yeah.
And like all the bands sounded like that, but they were still really, really good. Like Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains were incredible. But then fast forward, like, you know, I don't, maybe 10 years later, and you get bands like Creed, and it's just at that point, it's just a little too much. There's no substance, at least for a guy like me. I like stuff that's fresh and interesting. That's just the thing. I don't listen to as much commercial art, you know, commercial music. I don't know. I like things that are unique and quirky.
And so stuff brews, and then it pops up into the pop, you know, kind of realm, and it has depth or something like that. And then the stuff that copies, it doesn't have the depth or come from the quirkiness.
Yeah, and it's really rare to have artistic depth in popular culture. But you get things like back in the early 60s, like Bob Dylan comes out. And of course, he was basically a carbon copy of his hero, Woody Guthrie. But he was brand new for his generation. And then you get copycats. Everybody comes out sounding like Bob Dylan. Everybody wants to say something prophetic in their poetry of their folk songs. And then it gets watered down. And I see that as a trend. And I think that happens in art. It probably happens in architecture. You know, it might even happen in politics, where there's some new idea and you go for it, you try it, and then people come in trying to take advantage of that new system.
Yeah. Yeah. It just becomes a social climb, but originally it was art. Yeah. And then it's just a,
oh yeah, you're right. That I never thought of that. The social aspect of recognition or, I noticed that in emo, where at first there was no notion that you could become a quote unquote rock star, have any success. Right. As soon as that happened though, I started meeting young bands where they cared more about their pictures than on MySpace than they did about their, you know, guitar riffs. And you could just tell these people recognized that they could be quote unquote famous, and that was their goal.
Yeah. And they copied the trappings of the thing. Like when you mentioned Bob Dylan, yeah, profound, but it's so funny what he was able to do by having these magical type songs or whatever in such a weird aesthetic and sound and voice quality.
Yeah,
and
voice.
It's so funny to see people to this day copying the things about Bob Dylan that aren't good, which is like,
I remember that's such a good point. I remember when I was a kid, my parents' generation, they all talked about Bob Dylan like he had the worst voice in the history of music. They would actively say that in conversations, and I would hear his voice and think, well, yeah, that sounds really different than everybody else. But then in the 70s, you get guys like Tom Petty, and he's doing a full-blown Bob Dylan, but he's the biggest radio star at that point in time.
And Tom Petty's deep, but also not any kind of voice anybody, you know, tends to want to copy or say is good.
I feel like he is the version of Dylan that came after that and in the next cycle. You know, he's so original, even though he has his heroes just like Bob Dylan had his heroes, and it's everything sort of influenced by what came before it. Even I've been listening to this podcast, The History of Rock Music and 500 Songs, and yesterday was an episode on Little Richard, who you think of as this totally flamboyant, unique cultural personality, but he had his hero that was way more flamboyant than him, with a bigger pompadour and louder screams, and he was just doing his impression of that until he became Little Richard. And like Tom Petty started off with, I'm sure, his heroes and that he was trying to emulate, but then he becomes Tom Petty.
So it is all emulation in the end, but it's a matter of how deep you're emulating the pure thing versus the shallow thing.
I don't personally know if it's emulation. It's more inspiration. But some people really do try to emulate. I know when we first came out, when Saves the Day first came out, everybody said, "You guys sound exactly like Lifetime." And at the time that was true. That was the band that I loved the most by far. I liked Gorilla Biscuits and Lifetime. And if you were to blend their music, two bands together, it would probably sound like Saves the Day, but we were nowhere near as cool as those bands. We're just kids, you know, who love that kind of music. We just love fast melodic hardcore. So it's like the Beatles started out as this is not a comparison. I'm not jumping to any grand comparisons at all, but the Beatles started, obviously I'm not, but the Beatles started as a cover band playing Motown and their favorite songs and trying to rework Elvis Presley songs and stuff like that. And through their adoration of those musicians who inspired them, they became the Beatles and they developed their own sound.
And then you arrive at something like true self-expression.
Yeah, I think so. Once you, it's almost like, you know, a kid that's born in any culture has to first adopt the manners and habits of their parents if they're going to, you know, participate in the social order. They learn the language and they learn the actions that are acceptable. And otherwise, what would they be if they were just born in the wild? They'd probably make grunting noises like animals, you know. So we all are learning as we come into the world what it's all about, and then we respond to the things that we love or hate, rather. And then if you are somebody that does speak your mind, I think you wind up wearing your influences on your sleeve when you're younger. But I still am proud to wear my influences on my sleeve. I mean, my entire last album, it's called Nine, was basically a musical love letter to the musicians and artists that inspired me growing up and continue to inspire me. The whole record is a tip of the hat to bands and artists that lit up my life. So I love being inspired by stuff. You know, I'll hear something on the radio and think, oh my God, that is such a cool chord, you know? And then I try to find it on the guitar. That's just fun.
Wow. Okay. So we've covered a lot of stuff. I don't know if these are all, you know, your influences, but you've named it just a bunch of really fascinating and deep ones, you know, over time. But let's zoom into Lifetime and Gorilla Biscuits. Let's zoom into New Jersey. And what awesome. Was your awakening, like where you thought, I can do something, like I can participate? When was that?
That's a good question. I never once thought that. I never once thought, oh, I could be part of this. That was our drummer, Brian Newman. He was he's the only other original member of Saves the Day. We grew up together and went to school together in Princeton, New Jersey. And he started playing drums before I started playing guitar. I was playing cello in the orchestra at school. And then I gave up cello and started playing guitar when I was 13. And that summer when I came back,
Why did that happen? Why give up cello?
Because I got so into Led Zeppelin. I became completely obsessed in a way that I can't even describe. Completely obsessed with Led Zeppelin. I would listen to them literally constantly throughout the day. And I just couldn't get enough of it. I think my ears liked it because there's a lot of classical music in there. In their music, and my ears had been trained in the orchestra on classical music starting when I was 6 years old. I played for 7 years in the school orchestra, and that was a formative experience. But by the time I heard Led Zeppelin, I'll remember the moment exactly. I was driving up to upstate New York with my dad, and I had my Discman in the passenger seat, and I was listening to Led Zeppelin IV, and it's the moment in Stairway to Heaven where John Bonham enters the song. The drums mm-hmm. come in on a fill. Yep. It just goes crack, dum, 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 dum. If there's a bustle in your hedgerow. Yep. And I rewound it about 10 times. And the feeling of excitement I got when John Bonham, when the drums came in, was exuberant enthusiasm. And it was a light bulb moment. I said, oh my God. I looked up at my dad, took off my headphones. I said, Dad, I want to play the drums.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, well, let's talk about it when we get home. By the time we got home, he'd thought about it and he thought, you know, we live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of open space and only a handful of neighbors. And he didn't want to bother the neighbors with the loud banging of the drums. He said, but I'll buy you an acoustic guitar. And so he got me the acoustic guitar and I taught myself Stairway to Heaven. And then I was just in love with learning the guitar. I was self-taught. I just bought a book on 12 bar blues. And then I bought, the Led Zeppelin IV tablature, because I couldn't read. The school of music where I was taught in Princeton was called the Suzuki method.
And yeah, I know that method.
They teach you to learn by ear, mm-hmm. and they refuse to teach you to read. Good. And sometimes I thought
I'm a believer in that. Yeah,
yeah, it'd be easier to read sometimes because I thought I could just figure this, just look at it and know how to play it. But they made you learn it by ear. And so that helped, later when I could sit with a record and listen for what they were doing. But with Led Zeppelin, yeah, I bought the Led Zeppelin IV tablature and a book of 12 bar blues and taught myself guitar. That was over the summer of after seventh grade. I was 13 years old. And when I came back from summer break, Brian Newman, our original drummer, he said, hey, I heard you learned to play the guitar. You should come jam with me and Justin. So Justin Gaylord was also another original member of Say Zay, but he left before the first album came out. They would jam Black Sabbath riffs in Brian's parents' basement and they would record it on a boombox. And they'd mm-hmm. come into the lunchroom cafeteria during lunch and play these awesome homemade tapes where they play Black Sabbath or Rage Against the Machine riffs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is so cool. But that was before I started playing guitar. And so when I came back, he said, hey, come on over and jam. And that was the beginning. But Brian was the one that said, hey, come on over and play with us. I don't think I would have thought, oh, I should start a band. I just really, really loved the guitar. I was a lonely kid growing up. And the guitar was, I mean, I was not a lonely kid growing up. I just grew up as an only child isolated on a farm. And the guitar was like my best friend. Mm-hmm. So I just clung on to that thing. And it was enough. Just playing the guitar was enough to fascinate me. And but yeah, then Brian pulled me into the group. And Brian was the one that had the notion or the ambition to get started trying to book shows and play in New Jersey, all over New Jersey. The cool thing about Brian was that he had already joined a hardcore band, I think in seventh grade. He joined a hardcore band in New Jersey called A Nation in Transit, and he was their drummer for a year or so. So they played hardcore shows in New Jersey. He's like 13 years old playing hardcore shows. A lot like Sammy Siegler in Youth of Today and Gorilla Biscuits. He was a kid. They had to smuggle him in the bass drum case, I'm told. Brian was like that. He was a little kid in the New Jersey hardcore scene. He's the one that said, we can totally play these shows. So we would just go and hang out and talk to musicians. And over the years, every time we could raise enough money to make a recording, we'd make a tape or a demo or a CD or a 7-inch, and little by little we found other bands that were also in that sub scene. It was all just in basements and backyards basically back then. Mm-hmm. And eventually we made friends with a band called Second Hand. And Second Hand was extremely industrious. They were really motivated to create their own culture and create their own scene. And we loved one another. So every single show we played was Saves the Day, or sorry, we weren't called Saves the Day then, was us and Second Hand. And Second Hand were maybe a couple years older than us. So they had more capabilities of traveling farther with somebody's borrowed car or whatever, and they knew people in farther reaches of New Jersey where we could spread out. And we just started playing any show that we could. We'd play like in the back of a, you know, half hallway that was a makeshift record shop. You know, we'd play anywhere. We'd play on the curb outside of a Wings, Hot Wings joint in Princeton. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the police would always come and shut it down.
And this is 95 or something like that?
94, 95, 96. That was all happening. So Brian and I started playing together in 1993. And then by 1994, we were playing shows. We played like the community, the Princeton Fet. It was like a fair, like a festival day in Princeton. We'd play that. It'd be a battle of the bands. We did several battle of the bands. We came in second one year. It was pretty cool. I jumped into the drums like Kurt Cobain. But then our bass player's dad made him leave the band because he didn't want his son to be around that kind of mischief.
Right.
but so it was just very innocent and it was all friends from school. And then we found a bass player and a singer from another nearby high school. And it just sort of started to branch out like that. That was before I was the singer of the group. I just was the guitar player that wrote the songs. And then eventually Brian said, well, you should just sing because you write all this stuff and, let's just do it like that. So then we became a four piece. It was, myself, Brian, Leif Forer, and Justin Gaylord. And that was our band that we turned into, our name eventually became Seffler. And that was the band that, after our bass player was asked to leave the band by his dad, it was just a three piece of me, Justin, and Brian. And shortly thereafter, we got another bass player named Dan Corey. And we started to, for a while, our sound was evolving from one genre to the next. As we were going through different influences, we sounded like Smashing Pumpkins for about 6 months and then Sunny Day Real Estate for a while. But then I got really into punk rock. Brian introduced me to punk rock. He won concert tickets to go see The Offspring in City Gardens in Trenton. We went to see that. And the first band was Sheer Terror, but then the next band was Rancid. And wow. I was right up front at the edge of the stage looking right up at Lars. And I'd never seen anything like it. At that point in time, punk rock was not popular. I saw these guys with their mohawks and chains and plaid pants and suspenders and piercings through their nose. And my jaw was dropped. And the very next day, we, Brian and Justin and I, we dyed our hair green and spiked it up. And then we, from then on, we were a punk band. And every time we changed a genre, every time the band's sound changed so much, we would change our band's name. The first name of our band was Indifference. And then it was something like Apathy Jane. And then eventually we wound up with Seffler. And Seffler was just a made up word. It was a typo one day in our computer class. Back then you had to take typing computer class. And this is before the internet happened. And we would just sit next to each other and laugh, you know, being silly on the computer. And there was not linked up to a network. You were just in a room with a bunch of computers and everybody was learning how to type. So it was literally how to hold your hands on a keyboard. And one day Seffler was a typo. And we thought, hey, that should be the name of our band. So that was the name of our band leading up to the day when we finally saved up enough money to record a demo with our favorite producer at our favorite studio, Steve Evitz, who had produced Lifetime and the studio Trax East in South River, New Jersey. And we saved up $500 so we could spend one day with him. We went in and recorded the songs. And at this point, we had evolved out of the punk rock genre that Seffler had morphed into. And Brian had turned me on to Lifetime because I was obsessed with Screeching Weasel at the time. And his lyrics were really super nasty and smarmy. But the songs were super fun and catchy. And Brian said, he realized every song I wrote sounded like Green Day, Rancid, or Screeching Weasel. So he wanted to expand my horizons, and he said, "Hey, you'll love this new Lifetime record. Listen to the lyrics." He played me "The Gym Is Neutral Territory." And the lyrics were exactly like Screeching Weasel. So immediately I was like, I love this. And it was only, it was kind of like pop punk-y, that song. It was a pop punk-esque song. And I immediately loved it. And I took the CD home and just sat there reading all the lyrics and listening to it. My life was changed. And then our band morphed into a sort of semi-melodic, high-intensity, high-speed hardcore. And that's when we were starting to play a couple more shows that were circling around the hardcore scene in New Jersey. But when we went in to make that demo with Steve, our bass player Dan couldn't come that day. His dad made him go to a crew meet because he was trying to get whatchamacallit for college. One of those, what do you get it when you get money for college? A scholarship.
Scholarship, yeah.
So he didn't show up that day. Yeah, he didn't show up that day in the studio, and we're like, great, this is our one big shot with Steve Evitz. But so I played the bass on that recording, but as we were scrambling to try to deal with Dan not being there, our guitar player Justin had the number of Sean McGrath, who was the bass player for the biggest hardcore band in New Jersey, Mouthpiece. And Sean was going to school at Rutgers down the road from where we were recording. And he said, "Well, I'll come by. I'll check it out." So Sean came to the studio and was hanging out while we were making the demo all day long. And he, at the end of the day, as Steve was mixing the tracks, he said, "You know, this stuff is really cool. You guys could totally play hardcore shows, but your name is really weird. It would look so weird on a flyer, Seffler." And he just said, without it like being a big moment or anything, he just the big moment or anything, he said, "I always thought Saves the Day would be a cool name for a band." And we were like, "That's cool. Like, where's that from?" He said, "It's from my favorite song by the band Far Side. It's called Hero." And he says, "I want to be the one that saves the day." And there we, right then and there, before we even left the studio, we entered the studio called Seffler. But when we left with the demo tape, we had Steve print out on the tape, "Saves the Day." So that's the moment we turned, became Saves the Day. And then that weekend, since Sean was in the biggest hardcore band in New Jersey, Sean had actual connections. And Sean was on, Sean was also in a side project called Hands Tied. And Hands Tied was incredible youth crew hardcore. And Hands Tied were signed to Equal Vision Records. And we couldn't believe it. Equal Vision was putting out some of our favorite music. We were so, we were obsessed with Youth of Today and Shelter primarily. And we were starting to get interested in vegetarianism and that the whole culture was appealing to us. And so Sean had these connections. And that very, the weekend after we made that demo tape, he got us a gig at Rutgers playing a festival day at Rutgers with MC Light, of all people, who didn't show up. So it was just us playing in this huge auditorium where no one was within 100 feet of the 30-foot tall stage. And they're all playing in these bounce houses. And like it was like a fair, and they were playing games and nobody was paying attention to us. And then Sean says, "Hey, my friends in the band Ignite are playing New Brunswick right down the street in a couple hours." Let it go, let it bleed, let it bleed, let it go, let Sean I bet if we go down there, they'll let us hop on their gear before they play, and we could play four songs from the demo. We're like, really? And so, sure enough, we left the Rutgers show and headed down to New Brunswick, where Ignite was playing. And Ignite was a touring band from California. And those guys are the nicest, sweetest, coolest dudes ever. And they said, absolutely. And they love Sean from Mouthpiece. And so we got to hop on their equipment, and we played four songs from the demo, and the show was packed, absolutely packed. And our guitars were all out of tune and sounded terrible, but we had the demo tape, and we sold it for a dollar, and people bought it, and they liked it, and they said, "Oh my God, you guys sound like Lifetime." And and then that was it, and then we were off and running, and we started playing hardcore shows all over. Through Sean's connections, we started getting more and more hardcore shows. And then the coolest thing happened. About 6 months into playing with Sean and playing all these hardcore shows, we got a phone call from Steve Reddy from Equal Vision Records, and he said, "Hey, I hear you're in this band with these kids from New Jersey." Sean was a little older than us, and I hear it's pretty good. I want to come check you guys out. So that weekend we were playing in Pennsylvania with 10 Yard Fight. And so we went and Floor Punch. All of these bands are legendary hardcore bands in that scene. And we were like so psyched to just go and play, but Steve Reddy was going to be there. And sure enough, he showed up. He watched us. He took home the demo tape. And then about a week or two later, we got a phone call while we were rehearsing in Justin's mom's house in Princeton. The landline rang, and it was a call for Sean. It was Steve Reddy. And he said, "Hey, let's make a record." And so Steve said he wanted to make a record, an actual LP with Saves the Day on Equal Vision Records. And we just went through the roof, jumping up and down. It was the most exciting moment of my life, aside from in the future when my daughter would be born.
Wow. So that journey you just described had many moments of life. It sounded like many life-changing moments in there, and a lot of lessons, I think, things to be gleaned from that. If you,
For sure.
From where you started with the John Bonham drum intro to that moment is yeah. Only, it doesn't sound like a really long amount of time, but a tremendous amount of life experience.
Oh, absolutely. That moment when I realized I wanted to play drums, I was 13. And my dad got me the guitar. And then by the time we made the demo tape in April, it was April 17th, 1997. And that's the day we changed our name to Saves the Day. So that was 4 years later. So Brian and Justin and I played together for 4 years, morphing through different genres of music. That's why Saves the Day, the music always changes, because we were always just... Mm-hmm. We never decided on one thing. We just play whatever we like. And so we happened to wind up on this melodic hardcore sound 4 years later. And that's when we got signed.
Yeah, just as things unfold that way. I don't want to spend time really about me, but I'd have to just resonate with your experience because mine is so similar. Main difference being that I graduated high school in 97, so I imagine we're the same age. What year did you graduate?
Same age.
Yeah. Okay, so we're the same age. But I was in rural South Carolina. You say farm, but your farm was near a bunch of cool shit. And my farm, yeah. I was in the middle of the woods, nowhere near anything like culture. Nobody at my high school or anybody had ever even had like a band or anything. You know, it was very rural.
How did you first get excited about?
Well, yeah, that's what, so to me, it was the same. It's like once I felt the intro to Smells Like Teen Spirit on the drums, I said, somebody's got to get me some drumsticks. Like, it's that same thing.
You're
it's a life changing
moment. You're kidding me.
Somebody's got to get me some drumsticks.
Rock and roll goosebumps.
Yeah. It's when I heard that, I was like, cool. Oh, that is the thing that I feel like I felt like an outsider I didn't care about that was the energy, that spoke to me that the teachers didn't like, that I like, whatever it was. I was like, that's what I'm like, is whatever that is.
All over.
And so I got a pair of drumsticks and just started trying to figure out what the patterns were on pillows. I mean, nothing. And then I got a guitar and had to figure out by ear, I'm an ear guy. I have, and so it, similar kind of path, found some people to jam with, and they invited me over and let me play. Once I learned some guitar, they let me play with them and just see how many Nirvana songs and grunge songs we could get through, like without, you know, just call them out and see if we knew them and just kind of slop through them, or just same kind of experience you were having. But that was later for me. That was like in... I was just a little bit of a later bloomer, more sheltered, not around as much culture. So it's a lot more slow development path, because Emory doesn't really get started. I don't really get that much experience or exposure or to be around talented people for several more years. So by the time Emory's first record comes out, it's 2004. It took us a long time to gain the experience that you got being around a scene. You know,
I could imagine, because we were lucky enough to be way, like you said, way up there in the Northeast, and there's so much happening. And and so we were 60 miles from both Philadelphia and New York City, New Brunswick which is a college town where Rutgers is, was just right down Route 1 from Princeton. So there was so much opportunity. So I think things were accelerated, but that is a direct parallel trajectory. That is cool.
But I was more like 15. Something like that. I got drumsticks sometime, but it took me a long time to eventually figure out how to get somebody to have a bass amp or get a drum set out of, you know, like even collect the instruments took years for me to, you know.
I'm glad you brought that up, because another aspect of how lucky we were was we had parents that were extremely supportive. And I think they were glad that we weren't out drinking and doing drugs like a lot of like other teenagers might have been and causing any trouble. All we wanted to do was jam in the basement. We were at their houses all weekend long.
Right.
They knew exactly where we were. And so our parents helped us get the early equipment. And I mean, my mom bought our first van, even though the thing broke down before we even hit the first exit heading out of New Jersey on our way to Baltimore. She was the one that helped us get started, and Brian's parents and Justin's mom, they helped us, have a place to play, anytime. They helped us get to and from, events, 'cause we didn't have driver's licenses or cars. Yeah. And they helped us get equipment. And then it wasn't until we were freshmen in high school when we met David Soloway, who was he was 1 year ahead of us. And David Soloway wasn't an original member of Saves the Day, but he joined after our first album. The way that David became friends with us was we were all the weird kids that sat at the lonely table in the back of the lunchroom. And we all, you know, were into the same kind of stuff. And David was a little bit older than everybody. And already, even in when he was a sophomore, already had a license and already had a Volvo station wagon. So David became our manager, and David would drive us. We would load all our equipment into the back of his Volvo, and he would drive us to like the Princeton Fete or down the road to some pizza shop. And he was the one that got us from point A to point B. And we were always good friends with David. And he was a good guitar player, but he came from a country bluegrass background. So he was more of a chicken picking kind of guy and he wasn't like a punk rock guitar player. So it wasn't a natural fit. But after we came home from the very first tour from Can't Slow Down, right before Can't Slow Down was released, we went on our first national tour. We came home from that and our guitar player, Anthony Anastasio, had it, and he quit the band. He wanted to quit when we were halfway through the tour in Indianapolis, but thank God he stayed in the band. And our roadie at the time, Ted Alexander, he was just a roadie. He learned all the guitar parts to see if he could play the guitar if Anthony were to bail on the band. And he didn't do that, but by the time we got home, he left. And so David was the guitar player that we were closest with, even though he couldn't play the punk rock parts just yet. We were like, okay, let's see if we can do this. So David joined the band right then after Can't Slow Down came out, and he took over on guitar. And shortly thereafter, Ted, who was our best friend, joined on guitar as well. And that December was when Sean McGrath left the band. And shortly after that, in about January 1999, we had been playing shows with this band called yearly. And they were incredible, an incredible three piece from Long Island. They, two of them wound up becoming, oh my gosh, I'm the Strider. And, but we loved their bass player, Eben D'Amico. He's the coolest bass player I'd ever seen in my life. And I'd say almost to this day, probably still is, aside from Rodrigo Palma. But we poached him. I'm sure I've had to pay for that dearly. But we poached Eben, and then that's when we finally had that five piece, Saves the Day lineup that lasted for about a year and a half. We did Through Being Cool and Stay What You Are together. And that was a great lineup. And then everything fractured, little by little, as when Brian finally realized he didn't want to play music anymore, and he left to pursue a career as a therapist. And once Brian left the band, I was the only original member left. That happened in 2001. And then ever since then, it's been a revolving door. It's always been a revolving door. Especially in the early days. And that one lineup we had was, I don't think we could have been together for more than, I don't know, let's say 2.5 years at a generous estimation. I have to go back and look, but now what's great is I've had the same guys with me, Rodrigo and Arun, for longer than anyone has ever been in the band. So thank God years later, I would finally find my guys.
Yeah. You got some great people and have been around a lot of great people. And I totally agree that bass playing on those records is just very standout. It's always been notable to me.
Very special, very special musician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a huge, I mean, that's just something I've always noticed, about your band and that bass playing particularly.
And you know what we realized, we didn't know this, but Sean McGrath played with a pick. And so it was like a grittier, hardcore bass sound. When Eben joined, he played with his fingers, and instantly you could just feel the warmth. And he was so melodic. He was just an incredible bass player. But when he left, the next guy to try out for the band played with the pick, and there was no way we were ever going to go back to a pick ever again. It had to be the sound of the fingers, and that's something Eben left his mark on for sure with the band. And cool. It wasn't until Rodrigo joined in 2009 that we got a bass player that could do everything. Brad can play with the pick. He could play with his fingers. He plays with his thumb. He plays muted bass. I mean, he's one of the smartest musicians I've ever known in my life. And Rod's my favorite bass player on the planet.
Yeah, well, your lineup is great. Last time I saw you was Showbox Market. In Seattle at Showbox Market.
Oh, awesome.
That was like a year or two ago or something like that.
Oh, cool. So you saw us with Chris.
Yeah, with Chris. So yeah, Chris is, hero of mine from, number one. He's a number one gun playing Saves the Day, and he's a member of Emory now. So he's somebody special.
I love him so much. And I met him through his band Surrogate here in Chico.
Surrogate,
when I first moved to Chico, I went to a local show at the Down Low, and this awesome band was playing, and they sounded to me kind of like Elliott Smith a little bit. Mm-hmm. And with maybe a little quasi mixed in there. And I was like, this band's awesome, dude. And then I met him coming up the stairs outside afterwards, and I said how much of a fan I was. And I've just been a fan of his ever since then. And Chris and I started a cover band with our buddies, Trevor and Rob, here in Chico, called Trippin' on a Hole in a Paper Heart. And we play only 90s grunge, like Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and stuff. When I started to play music with Chris, that's when I realized, holy moly, this guy is the most precise. He's the most technically proficient guitar player and background singer I've ever played with. And I always wanted somebody that could sing harmonies, and we have the same register voice, but he's such a solid, tight, rhythmical guitar player. And I noticed, because we would be playing covers, and you have to try to your best to match these very well-produced records.
Yeah.
And he plays it note perfect every time.
Yeah. Yeah. He has a very unique set of skills that make a very special thing.
He's the best.
He's a one of a kind for sure. It sounds like in your whole experience, a lot of these things that happened to you is just so fast. Like you, it seems like your intuitions must be, I guess I'm getting from this that you're an open person, open to experience, and then your intuitions tell you stuff and you just know to act on it, like in the moment.
I'm trying to get better with that part of it, but really I've just been lucky to be along for the ride. It was absolutely Brian Newman who initiated the entire adventure. And I never would have even thought to put an ad, you know, in the Princeton Record Exchange bulletin board to, hey, guitar players seeking band. I just love playing guitar. I didn't think about performing or anything like that. I like to write songs on my little Tascam 4-track, record the little demos. And then it wasn't until Brian got us involved. And Brian was the one that made all of this happen. Sean was the one that knew Steve Reddy. Steve Reddy and Dan Sanshaw and everybody at Equal Vision were the ones that took a shot on these little kids. And we made that demo tape when I was a junior in high school.
So early.
He took a chance on these 17-year-old kids. And at that time, I don't think there was really any notion that we could be some sort of semi-successful band. And everybody made fun of us for sounding like Lifetime. So yeah. It's all been fortuitous, and there's been ups and downs, but also lefts and rights. There's been mishaps and misadventures and mishits. And all of that has served to enrich the experience, but it's been both good and bad, but overall it's been absolutely, a dream that I couldn't even have imagined coming true. And so for me, it's just being along for the ride. Also the songs, the way that I write songs is I'm fortunate enough to hear music pop up in my head. Mm-hmm. And so it's not something that I'm consciously sitting down to think up. And if I'm lucky enough to hear a whisper of a melody in my head, I'll grab it out of the thin air and sing it into a recorder. And that way I won't forget it, cause I didn't come up with it, just floating around.
Yeah. I agree with that method of, you're the antenna that finds the go on an exploration and find the thing and bring it here.
Exactly. Yeah. That is the thing that I feel so fortunate for, along with everybody that was there to connect the dots along the way, in terms of the logistics and getting, you know, hooked up with the label and then playing shows and touring and all of our booking agents and everybody that has been a contributing member to the, you know, the enormous undertaking it is to have, you know, a nationally, internationally touring band, as you know. I feel so lucky that I get to have this personal relationship with the music. And it's something I take very seriously, and something I feel very, very fortunate to get to participate in. But I have to reiterate that it's not something that I can take credit for. It's something I hear in my head.
I believe you.
The way you just called it an antenna is exactly what it is.
Well, I mean,
the only thing I do is I pluck it out of the air and then I find the notes on the guitar. And I start riffing around to see, oh, what chords? I have so much fun figuring out what chords, what sequence works with this strange melody that floated in through a dream. And that's the thing that I do. And then what I do is I'm trained as a creative writer. So I'm trained in poetry. And so I love having fun with the words. And the words are also something that pops up. A certain phrase will pop up in my mind. I don't think there's anything special to this. I think everybody has intuition. Everybody has those strange, you know, unconscious impulses or thoughts or feelings or words or emotions that pop up that we didn't summon up. They show up. And so that's what I am. I work on those ideas as if I were a gardener and a seed. You know, a seed came out of the thin air, and let's see how this thing grows.
Yeah, I think that is, I think one of the reasons that what you're saying really validates is because, like, if you think of the scene, as I call it, all the stuff that there is, the whole, you know, Warped Tour scene and beyond, whatever, the all ages, yeah, emo, hardcore, everything, almost all of it happened after you were already there. I mean, you already had this special music that where else could you have gotten it unless you were specially tuned in to hear those whispers and bring them here.
Right.
And then
right.
lay some of the foundations for what then all the, you know, then it would, you know, explode after that. But you did a lot of this pre 9/11. I mean, this is, yeah, before right, it was commercial. Exactly. It's before all yeah. that. So it's not like you could have been getting it anywhere else. You know, this just right. comes from.
Well, what's really cool too, to speak to that point is, we had our sources of inspiration in the pre scene. So even before there was a scene that came out of the, you know, there was a bunch of bands that came along in our wave of music, like the Get Up Kids slightly preceded us. We come along. There's already bands like Cap and Jazz and Promise Ring out there. And Texas is the reason. Right, and right. we're like the younger kids who were like their little brothers. And, but they were, those guys were out there. Gorilla Biscuits were out there. Yeah. Minor Threat in the early 80s, Bad Brains.
But it wasn't these commercial, you know.
Those guys were out there scraping by, you know, playing in parking lots or, you know, or worse, you know, and mm-hmm. getting arrested, you know, and the whole thing would have been absolutely unthinkable at that time to predict, hey, this is going to turn into a whole new genre of music that's going to be a worldwide phenomenon as emo became. You get bands like My Chemical Romance and Fall Out Boy and Yellow Card. I mean, that festival in Lake Tahoe that you guys played was incredible. Jimmy World. I mean, how lucky, how fortunate are we all to get to be part of this? But also when I'm at those shows, I'm struck by how cool the music is. How lucky are we to get to be part of this scene of music where there's so many authentic artists writing incredible music that's heartfelt, emotional, powerful. Right. And then there's a scene around it of people who really care and whose lives have been transformed. And, you know, I only hesitate to call it something spiritual because of how that phrase rubs people the wrong way, but, you know, screw it. There's something mystical about the magic of all of that happening. Mm-hmm. And so I stand back, my mouth agape sometimes and tears down my eyes. I feel very, very lucky.
That's wild to hear. You know, like you said, there's no way we could have known it would even come to exist at the level that it would. And then even when it did come to exist, like let's say when Stay What You Are came out and all that, nobody thought it would stay here. It would exist decades later. And now it seems like it's going to stick around.
That is such a good point. Now it's almost like, hey, is this like the next classic rock, as my friend Dan from EVR says?
Right. Well, it's in music history now somehow.
Yeah. It's a real certifiable genre of music. And it feels almost funny to say it because I too feel the same way. Like it was totally seemingly a passing fad at that time. And we all I remember just feeling like, how cool is this? We get to play Madison Square Garden with Green Day and Blink-182. This is insane. But little did I know that the bands that would come along after us would take it way, way farther than we ever could. And it's just astonishing. I went to the My Chemical Romance shows a couple years ago in LA, and it was monstrous. I mean, Thursday and My Chemical Romance were playing these huge rooms, and everybody was waiting outside for like days. And these people weren't even alive when those bands were getting started. These were young kids that have found it now. So it's alive and it is doing well and it's thriving. Yeah.
But the notable thing to me still beyond anything is your originality and earliness to get there in that you're influencing bands like Fall Out Boy and such, you know, like you're there, you know. Like, do you remember that Warped Tour? All, what Warped Tour was that you were on where you just did acoustic?
We played 04 or 5 shows a day. Yeah, and I think it was 2006. We did two shows a day that year. We did one set on the main stage, and then we did one set in the acoustic basement stage that Brian Marquis was running. So we'd run back and forth across those parking lots and fields all day, carrying acoustic guitars and pushing amps and whatnot. And that was 2006. That, but the first Warped Tour we ever played was we did a week of shows in Texas and I want to say Louisiana even. This is a long time ago, 1999. We were asked to do 1 week of shows on Warped Tour, and we had so much fun doing that. And Green Day was on that one, and Quicksand, and Hot Water Music, and that was just a great time. So Warped Tour was already up and running, and we could only pray to be, you know, a big enough band to be part of that.
But that 2006 one was so big. We were on that one, and that was when the whole thing was so big. And you were already, you know, like had a multiple albums and careers, and those bands were all breaking, you know, like the whole scene was exploding at that time.
Exactly, which was so cool. We were already like past that wave.
That's right.
And all of that is only, you can only chalk it up to chronology. You know, it's only like the fact that certain things happened in a certain sequence of time, you know, because if we had been born later, we would have been part of that other wave, the future waves of emo. So it's just lucky chance of fate that we would be, Brian and I would be born at that time and go to the same school. And without him, none of that ever would have happened.
Yeah, without a lot of things, it wouldn't have happened.
For me, I don't mean the world of emo. I just mean Saves the Day, the band, never would have happened. Of course, emo itself is such an incredible, vast genre of infinite cool bands that emo was always going to happen. You know, Saves the Day was just a piece of that. But I do feel incredibly proud to have been a part of some of the earlier stages of emo. And one of the things I value the most is the fact that we were able to influence other bands. And when bands come up and say, you know, hey, we started our group because of Stay What You Are, Through Being Cool, or something like that, it's a real honor.
Yeah, I bet it is. Do you have another 30 minutes or so?
Yeah.
Okay. I know we're about an hour, but that's got, you know, a couple of things love to get into. I feel like we're just getting it going.
You know how Einstein explained relativity, where he's like 1 minute sitting on a hot stove is a lot longer than 1 minute speaking to an old friend.
No doubt.
Yeah. So no doubt. I'm having a time in my life. It feels like it's 15 minutes.
Okay, well, I got a couple other things that are really pressing that we've set the stage to talk about. But one thing that lands in the center for me is just the album In Reverie, and then the fact that all this happens to you, and then you go, you know, from Equal Vision to Vagrant to a major, you go to DreamWorks, you put out, you know, there's this, all this stuff is happening when all these bands are going to majors at that time, and there's so many stories of it not working out. But the dream was there for everybody. And I'm just, In Reverie is everybody in Emory's favorite Saves the Day album. Oh, it is totally awesome. My favorite. It's the one when I had to go back to get into the other ones, because when that happened, I was like, whoa, because the, like you said, your music changes over time, but it's like the musicality and the chromaticism and the tonalities and the sense of melody and the openness of that record. I mean, it's the greatest. I mean, I just am in love with it.
Thank you so much, Matt. That really means a lot to me. That's the most special album to me for certain.
But it lands in this weird place with the commercialism of the whole thing. So it's like, I'm just dying to know what that experience was for you, because it seemed like it's mixed with the fans and the...
Definitely mixed. And it felt like we were poised to be the biggest band in the world, touring with Green Day, Blink 182 and Weezer, and on the cover of magazines and signed to DreamWorks. And what's kind of interesting is all the people at DreamWorks absolutely loved that album, as did a bunch of other labels. It may have just been because we were doing very well commercially, but they all came into the studio multiple times listening to the album. Obviously, they spent a considerable amount of time mulling it over, and hey, we want to offer you guys this deal. We were wined and dined by all the labels. They all loved that album. But when it came out, our A&R guy, Luke Wood, said, you know, I've talked with all the radio programmers. They love Saves the Day, but this album doesn't fit the format they're going for right now. And at that time, there was a lot of Kid Rock and Puddle of Mud and Limp Bizkit. And so, you know, at that time, I had gone through a spiritual evolution. I was no longer feeling angst. I wasn't angry. And so I was reflective and dreamy. You know, dreaming about how wonderful and incredible life is.
Wind blows through a hole in the roof, brings your perfume like lilies to me, and all I can do is remember you.
And I wasn't born with religion, but I had found an experience that opened my eyes to the miracle and the magic of life. And that's where I was. And it just didn't fit the culture at the time. Also, because I wasn't feeling angst, you know, I wasn't straining to sing. You know, I didn't have that kind of energy to push my voice the way I used to, because which was effortless, because that's how I felt. By the time I'm writing In Reverie, I'm really sitting back with my head in the clouds after a massive bong rip and just thinking like, oh my God, oh, the Beatles song is so cool. And like, I love the way Paul McCartney sings. And I tried to learn how to sing in a different way, but it was because I felt different, you know? And also, you know, as on tour with the wear and tear of your voice, I'd also had to learn new techniques of how to sing, so I wouldn't blow out my voice. But primarily it was just a function of the music that was emerging out of me at that time and the feeling, the new feeling in my heart. And that's where that, I think we lost the some fans that were into it because it was part of that fad or trend. And we didn't sound, I didn't have that high pitched, strained, nasally voice as much anymore. And so we didn't sound like the other groups at all. And simultaneously, we're not doing the ooh, thing.
Oh man. Yeah. Yeah. The angst is definitely part of what was in the, you know, it sells in whatever way. That's the demographic
I get why people relate to that. And I do think I understand why a certain perspective that I had at that time writing In Reverie is kind of niche. It's a niche experience. It's not, you know, if we were all having that experience, we'd all be bowing down to the sun as it rose every morning. You know, we'd all be walking to the river carrying water back for our families. You know, so it's not a typical experience. And so that's okay with me. But that's just in hindsight, I recognize, oh, I totally get it. Why In Reverie at that time was shocking, but also so at that time we were massively successful with Stay What You Are. And if somebody came in as a fan on that record and then heard In Reverie, it is drastically different. There are songs that make sense to your average listener. Where you could tell, okay, this song kind of sounds like this song from Stay What You Are kind of sounds a little bit like In Reverie, like song like Nightingale or song like This Is Not an Exit or Cars and Calories could easily have been on In Reverie.
Can be seen, and it took by I'll help her.
The fans that were there from the start, I mean, the real diehard fans from even back to the demo, they witnessed us, our sound change from Can't Slow Down to Through Being Cool. They witnessed our sound evolve from Through Being Cool to Stay What You Are. And then from Stay What You Are to In Reverie. To me, if you go back, the band had always been changing. And I was there from day one in 1993. Right. And we'd been through 29 different stages of our musical evolution. So I was just growing as a songwriter and a guitar player and as a human and just expressing myself honestly. And so I didn't think twice about how someone who joined the fan base on Stay What You Are might take In Reverie. But it's very clear to me now.
Yeah, in hindsight, you can see it makes sense. But at the time, it must have been a painful experience, or did you become bitter at fans or the industry?
Yeah, I put it up there with one of the, you know, one or two hardest times in my life, for sure. But I also learned so much, and I'm extremely grateful for how my life evolved from that point on. And it's just been a very long road of a lot of learning. The hard way. And it's, I wouldn't at this point in my life, I wouldn't change things, but I, you know, if you'd asked me a year ago or something, I might've said something different, but thank God I've been fortunate enough to be able to, have the support to grow and change through all the uncomfortable moments as well. So that was a tough time, but it was also a great time. We got flown around on private jets and playing radio shows, and I got to go to the Super Bowl in a private jet with the Interscope guys, and that was while we were being wined and dined, and it was a crazy, you know, cool experience. Got to have dinner with Mo Austin, hear stories about Janis Joplin and George Harrison and Jimi Hendrix, and got to meet Lenny Waronker and talk about Brian Wilson, and it was just a very, very cool time. And we were also lucky to get a good deal with that. And, you know, when we asked to be let go, when DreamWorks folded, we wound up on Interscope, but we had already interviewed with Interscope and decided that wasn't the home for us. So when we asked to be let go of the contract, they were so generous and they fulfilled the entire contract. I was able to build a studio here where I can work forever. So thank God. We were very, very lucky in that way as well.
That's not one of the true horror stories then. Although it's painful, it seems like you understand that maybe learning things the hard way, maybe it's the only way, and that growth and pain go together.
Yeah, that could be very true. But I also think that if you had asked me at certain times, I would not have said, I would not have said that. I would have been downtrodden for certain right after that happened and for years to come. But I've been lucky enough to have the support of family and friends to get me through. And that's not in terms of difficult life experiences, that's like not a tough experience. People are out there with literally nothing, like no clothes on their back. And, you know, I mean, we live in this world and people are really, really struggling. So, you know, the journey I've been on has been one that is extremely privileged. Mm-hmm.
I hear that recognition. And so maybe to go one more level here, I was in Philadelphia recently and doing a show and hung out with a couple of guys, the guitar players, old guitar players from Me Without You. And they're about our age as well, similar background, similar everything. And I was catching up with them and I was seeing where they were at in their spiritual life, as you brought that up. So I'm curious about the spiritual stuff that you were saying that recently or also before In Reverie, but, I was talking to them about it and we were just catching up, like, where are you on this path on your journey? And because we come from, you know, a Christian background, but which is all infused with the music and the mystical and what it all means. So it's like, I've always known there's a lot there's a lot out there or in there or wherever it is or however it works. And Joseph Campbell came up and so it's like, yeah, yes. You've been on that too. Oh, I've been on that too. And then Chris Keene let me know that that's something that, that you're into or a fan of Joseph Campbell. And I'm just curious, if you don't mind, what is the mystical thing? I mean, what are you talking about when beyond stuff?
Well, the actual experience of life is so mysterious, we don't even know what it is. You know, you call it's, you know, the sky is blue in one language, but it's azul in another. You know, a tree or arbol, you know, what are these things? It's extremely strange. And if you just pluck your awareness down right inside of yourself, you look out of your eyeballs and listen with your ears and feel the wind on your skin, and notice these strange thoughts and feelings. I mean, how can you even begin to describe what is going on? So I have no idea what this mysterious thing is. But I do know that I'm in awe. I am in awe of it. And sometimes I'm bowled over by it and blown to bits. I got to pick myself back up off the floor under the sheer weight of existence itself. But Joseph Campbell is somebody whose life and whose life's work has inspired me so deeply that ever since I discovered him when I was 20 years old, he has been a constant source of knowledge and learning and security because he speaks about the mysteries of life with such authority that he makes me feel more stable and more capable of meeting this experience of life head on and diving deeper. And so for 20 years or so, he was my number one hero. And I would list, they used to have on iTunes all these lectures that he gave. They had maybe 100 lectures that had been recorded. And through the Joseph Campbell Foundation, they released them on iTunes. A couple years ago, they took them down, but so that they could start a podcast. So now there's a podcast called Pathways with Joseph Campbell that I listen to all the time. They put out 2 episodes a month. This month, it was on the quest for the Holy Grail. And ever since it came out on October 1st, it's just been in my ear. I listen to it constantly over and over again. And then on the 15th, they're going to put out a bonus episode. And so every month is a new theme. And I just look forward to it so much. Like the first of every month is Christmas.
Wow.
And, but a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I became interested in his hero, who is Carl Jung. So
Carl Jung
is a very famous psychiatrist, psychologist, psychoanalyst who was a pioneer in the science of the mind. And he and Sigmund Freud worked together for a little while at the beginning of his career. But then they split off because Carl Jung realized that there is an instinctive religious response in human beings. Mm-hmm. There's an instinctive religious drive to the mystery of life. There's something happens naturally in a human being where they open their eyes to the mystery and they wonder what it's all about. We're the only animal that we know does that determine the true nature of the mystery of life and the experience of being a human being endowed with this psyche and spirit and soul in these bodies that we don't understand. And his work over the last 4 or 5 years has been the link between myself, my questions, my wondering, and my path on the way to trying to understand this mysterious experience of life. Carl Jung has the collected works of Carl Jung is a vast treasure trove of tidbits from all kinds of aspects of human beings' journey throughout the eons to understand this experience that we're all collectively going through. And his work now is the only thing I will ever need from here on out it is the, it's like a Bible that's a million pages long, for me. I just this morning finished a book, that someone else wrote about his, perspective on synchronicity and religion, his psychology of synchronicity and religion. Mm-hmm. And then, but simultaneously, I'm also reading a book that Brian Newman gave to me when he left the band called Synchronicity, an Acausal Connecting Principle. Brian gave me that book so many years ago, and I only got through about 18 pages on a train trip down to see him in North Carolina after he'd left the band. And then I put it away in a backpack, and I moved out to California not too long after that. And I only just found that in a box at my mom's house as she was moving about 2 weeks ago. I found the book Synchronicity. And oddly enough, as it were, as I had already started the book, The Psychology, Carl Jung's Psychology of Synchronicity and Religion. So sure enough, I discover the book that Brian gave me all those years ago in a box. And I immediately thought, oh my God, I can't wait to read this. But at the time, I was simultaneously finishing Carl Jung's wife's, Emma Jung's, book on the Holy Grail. And when I finished, I found his book and I thought, oh my God, I need to start this, but I can't start this until I finish her book about the Holy Grail. And then sure enough, in the final few chapters of her book, she says, if the reader wishes to inquire further, he should direct his attention to Carl Jung's Synchronicity and Acausal Connected Principle.
Wow. And there's some synchronicity right there. And
exactly.
Know, I, yeah, but you don't understand the amount of that I'm experiencing over here, because that's, I mean, you know, I'm exploring every bit of this territory myself. I'm, again, late getting to it. You've been here, but I'm completely taken by all these exact
Matt, it is
things,
so, it is so meaningful and so fun to meet another member of the community of searchers. I'm so glad that you have those experiences too. It's just enriching. It doesn't it feel like a reward finding long lost friends?
Yeah, well, I'm just, you know, explore is me, curious. Like, that's just, you know, I'm open, but I'm kind of slow.
Wonder on the way.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I come from the Christian background, and I've just always deeply known that there's just things are profound, but is it this? Is it that? How does it really work? And you know, there's just a lot to explore. But the connection of music and what God is, and what the collective unconscious is, and what I am, and how it all fits together is bigger and bigger all the time. You know what I mean? There's more and more.
Oh, incredible. You know,
I have
wild.
To reboot and because I don't really throw out anything from my past. I start to just see how it's all bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah,
but
like,
you know, music is so super central to it, to me.
It's like finding your way back home, and you get little signs along the way. And this, you go down the path this way, but it dead ends at a river you can't get across. But then you hear a bird chirp to your right, and you look and you see there's a bridge halfway down the way, but it needs to be reconstructed. You know,
yeah.
It's that kind of thing. And we're finding our way as we go. And I believe Joseph Campbell says, every single world religion is true in its metaphorical sense of its approach, its estimation of trying to communicate these mysteries. Because the experience is so beyond words, you have to use poetry and
myth,
metaphor,
and music and lyrics and all those things. Yeah.
If it were that easy to explain, like I said, we'd all be bowing down, praising the sun or the Tao. T-A-O, the first religion I connected to was Taoism. I don't know if you're familiar. It's an ancient religion from, I believe a Chinese philosophy coming along down the millennia. And the I Ching is part of this kind of the way that the ancient religions were learning about life. And Taoism was the first one that spoke to me, but I didn't find it. This is another one of those things where it was a friend that gave it to me. My friend Terrell Wright gave me the Tao Te Ching, T-A-O-T-E-C-H-I-M-G, I believe, Tao Te Ching. And I'm pretty sure I'm saying that right, but I'm also, I only read these things. I very, very rarely pronounce them, phonetically. Mm-hmm. I don't see. So I might be butchering, absolutely butchering that, and may have completely gotten the title of that wrong. But he gave me the Tao Te Ching, and that's what connected the dots for me immediately. It's more based on nature and the experience, the raw experience of life. I grew up on a farm. And as an only child, and my first relationship was with nature. So the way that it speaks about life through natural images, it worked for me. It was like, it just spoke to that little kid that grew up on the farm. And that's when the light bulb went on, and I bought every book I could on Taoism, and eventually got tattoos that are early Taoist symbols for certain things that are meaningful to me out of a book of daily meditations called Everyday Tao. And they were little characters of a word that might mean dawn. And then underneath, a half page long meditation on the whole nature and concept and idea of dawn, when the sun rises. So I picked out seven symbols that represented seven meditations and put them on the back of each arm. So I got 14 Taoist symbols on my arms. And that's the quote unquote religion, I would say, that I connect the most to. I also connect to Buddhism, but more and more as I'm able to read the language of the mythology of Christianity, I really love the message there as well. And I also studied at NYU, I studied the history of Islamic Europe, Muslim Europe. And so I was able to find in the mysticism of Islam and Sufism, where the great poet Rumi comes from, also connecting principles there. And as we in the mysticism of Judaism and the Kabbalah and all of that, and all of these things very much influence me and inspire me. And so
I did not know this. You know, Chris mentioned yesterday that you like Joseph Campbell. I was like, oh yeah, but I didn't realize that there was all this here for you. But it's really fascinating to me, because it's like, and I used to would have been very scared to explore or even hear the stuff you're talking about. I would have thought that sounded something weird about it. But when I read Joseph Campbell and Jung, it just seems like they understand Christianity and Jesus, who I'm compelled by most, better than most of the people that I learned, your average pastor.
I agree. And the thing I love about them too, is they approach these things from an academic scientific point of view to remove the mysticism, to remove the doubt. And they only talk about direct experiences or symbols that arise. And they don't venture a notion of what this is. We have no idea what this is. This could just be a bubble on the blip of an eternal ocean. Who knows? But they speak about human beings in their pursuit to understand the nature of life and to uncover the mysteries, and in a way that makes me feel reassured and safe and secure. And I know that they have provided the map that we need to find our way back to the root.
Because they just speak from and about experience in that experience way.
No theory. There's very little theory involved. It's experience. It's analytical. It's observational. And Carl Jung, especially, I can't imagine the Herculean effort that this man made. And he underwent the original experience in terms of diving to the depths of his psyche within. And I'm sure he was terrified with the confrontation with the unconscious, mm-hmm. and which mm-hmm. is a phrase I'm not sure sums it up. The unconscious makes it seem like something lower than consciousness, or even though it implies something unknown. So unconscious just means we're not conscious of it, which is clearly the case. I mean, how is it that life exists? We don't know. Mm-hmm. So, but we are conscious of the experience of life. And so this man plunged into the depths, and he did so in such a brave manner. I believe the world owes him a tremendous wow. debt. But what's really, really cool, the other day I was listening to a podcast, a Jungian podcast, and it was these two people talking about BTS. And I thought, wait a second, they're talking about like the band BTS? Sure enough, as it turns out, that group's entire expression is based on their experiences having to go through depth psychology when they were starting to become famous. The pressure on them was too much, and they started to come apart at the seams. And thank God someone focused them in on Jungian and analysis. And they went to Jungian therapists, and they uncovered the experience, the uncertain experiences they were going through to understand what they were going through, all through the work, the help of Carl Jung's exploration and creation of depth psychology.
When you talk about the unconscious being such a big thing, you know, they say maybe that's the real supercomputer and we're just aware of a little bit over here, but maybe that's where you hear some of those whispers of those melodies and
yeah, exactly.
musical ideas.
That's where it's coming from. And people in the past had different names for the various aspects of this mysterious thing that we're experiencing. They used to call them the muses, those ones that would whisper the melodies in your ear. And sure enough, it's been an astounding, mysterious experience for me. And it's been the gift of my life to get to participate in it.
That's amazing how everything can connect in that way. And so you feel like you'll compose music and perform both of those forever?
Permanent? Ever and ever. I feel so lucky. And I'm now at a point in my life.
Is there anything
where
else you want to accomplish?
If I can help anybody feel more at home in themselves, and more at peace, then that would be my life's goal. But also I'd love to entertain
Amazing.
People with cool songs and cool words. Just have some fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you still get juice out of performing, and even performing this music that's so old.
Oh,
like you're doing the tours you're doing right now are 20 year in Reverie. That's the tour you're doing that
and
stuff.
25
you know, now,
years
right?
of Can't Slow Down. And what's incredible about it is that the lyrics get more and more rich for me as the years go by. And it's a direct experience of synchronicity itself, where I recognize singing a line that I wrote when I was 17 years old, that it only makes sense to me now. And
wow.
And I was only following an impulse back then. I was trained to write stream of consciousness in the style of stream of consciousness. So you'd put your pen down and you would just let your hand go. And then you'd go back and underline the bits you liked. And then I would just crowbar those lines into the lyrics. And it's so I'm consciously not thinking of the line. And it's the strangest, most incredible, mystical experience to be on stage, as a 40 some odd, how old am I? 43 year old man, singing a song I wrote when I was 17 and finally understanding it. I understood it all the time. Yeah. On certain levels, and now I understand from a deeper level what those lyrics mean to me now after I've gone through 20 some odd years of growth. It's incredible. So I like singing those songs. I like singing all of the Saves the Day songs. I think especially because I've just been a fan the whole time, fielding these ideas and having fun playing around with them and turning them into songs.
Well, I am glad to have spent the time to uncover some of this stuff about you that, you know, I've enjoyed the music for a long time, but, you know, I never had a conversation with you or anything. I'm really thrilled that we've been able to do it today. And I hope people see these shows.
Yeah, man, I'd love to hang out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised we haven't already, but I'm sure we'll get the opportunity because I'm going to keep on going and you're going to keep on going.
I'm sure we stood in line together at Warped Tour with plates in our hands. Waiting for lunch.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, no, I remember seeing you on that Warped Tour, but I mean, you know, if we're both going to keep going, I'm sure we'll get more time
there,
to
my
hang
friend.
Out.
I can't wait to high five.
And y'all got West Coast shows coming up. This will be out probably next week, and you got shows next week. something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're playing a couple weeks.
Shows, y'all are West Coast.
A couple shows in the West Coast, and then we're playing the When We Were Young Festival in late October. I can't wait for that. It's going to be so much fun.
Amazing. I'll probably see you there.
Oh, heck yeah. You guys are there too.
Chris, thank you so much. Yeah, I think so. I don't know that that's announced or whatever.
But awesome.
It's my understanding that we'll be there this year.
Well, Matt, I can't wait to meet you in real life. And I had so much fun talking. Thank you so much for wanting to do this conversation for the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Chris. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.